Do you understand what I mean here? Most of the time, I mean the space-time, flat space-time with constant silent parameter, that is constant, h dot over h squared parameter. So, and I will be using dimensional localization in spite of what we heard this morning. Nevertheless, even though we did renormalize, I will actually not... I will focus my attention mostly to the infrared sector. So these are my collaborators, so I'll speak mostly about these four papers, and I'll also mention briefly in the end the results of this work with Tomi Koivisto, who is my postdoc, and he's applying this year, so you should be aware of this. So this is the outline. So I will begin with the work I've done, Miao and collaborators, about what we call Hubble effective potential. In other words, the idea here is how to generalize the notion of effective potential to make it suitable to cosmology. And then I will go on with discussing the effect of back reaction. That means how the quantum stress energy tends the back reaction to the metric. And I will do it in two different frameworks. One is the so-called sudden matching of radiation to inflation type of setting. And the other one is trying to resolve some problems that appear here due to the sudden matching. And I will also present a model where we managed to do the smooth matching procedures. And then I will outline some problems for the future. Let me begin with the Hubble effective potential calculation. So as you probably all know, you know, there's a famous paper called Weinberg, Eric Weinberg.
Yeah.
So in some sense this work is a slight generalization of what they did. And we call it Hubble effective potential, and it's going to become clear in a moment why Hubble. Of course, what you do when you construct effective action, for example, for a scalar field, you decompose the scalar into the background scalar, and it's a fluctuating scalar. And then basically you integrate out the fluctuating part, and you get the effective potential. And normally what you do is you actually, your background scalar is just a constant or a very weakly varying field. And in that approximation, you can then integrate the fluctuating part in perturbative expansion. But what if this guy is not a constant? And in particular, there is no reason in cosmology why pi zero should be constant. And as we know, in cosmology, typically it's a function of time. So then the effective potential will in general differ. And so the question is precisely what way the effective potential will differ is what I will address today in a certain particular simple setting. So what we observe is actually when you neglect the mass term, and often in cosmology you can do that, for example, inflation, that is often justified to do that, that quite generically the field, the background field scales as a constant, now a genuine constant, times the Hubble parameter. And in this situation, you can actually solve for the effective potential under some further assumptions that you're going to see. Let me try to convince you that this is not that this is actually a fairly reasonable assumption. And I'll just write, I'll assume I have lambda phi to the Ford model. If you add the mass term and the nonlinear coupling, this is how the equation on motion for the background field looks like. And I think we've seen this equation already this morning. And as I said, if the expectation value of the field is large enough, or if this term is bigger than that term, then you can actually neglect that guy in comparison to that. And now I'll make the further assumption is I will not work now anymore in general Friedman orbital Walker spaces, but I'll assume that the epsilon parameter of slow inflation is a constant. Not necessarily a small parameter, but a constant. And I can plug this ansatz here into this equation, and And after a couple of steps, this is basically the equation you get. And since I'm European, I can actually solve this equation.
If you went to school in the US,
if I,
partial contamination.
So I can solve this equation phi 0 as a function of epsilon lambda. And under certain conditions, you can actually see that this equation has a minimum. So it's a well-defined solution. And so what it means, having this in mind, is actually that phi indeed scales as h in this particular situation. Now, well, I will not present the details of the calculation. So I think that this formula is about as complicated.
That's only for phi 4.
That yes.
Your previous argument that phi goes like h is only true for phi 4. I mean, at least the way you present it.
Yes. Yes. It's not a general answer. I don't know, can you see everything here? So this is about as complicated as we've seen this morning, right? This is basically an exact answer. Now, what we did is we used actually a propagator that you can construct explicitly for those space times, and we've used a propagator in Kolmogorov box to infrared regulate it. So you have we have used the measure localization to ultraviolet regulated and the Kolmogorov box to infrared regulated. So there is this horrible expression. And because of this infrared box dependence, there is also a power law dependence on the scale factor, not logarithmic dependence. So there is a crucial difference between the Sitter space, where you have these infrared logs, logarithms of scale factor that appear in loop corrections. But here, as you see, there is actually power law dependence. Now, of course, I don't expect you to actually understand what this means. I would just say that in the limit when phi is much greater than h, this actually does reproduce Coleman-Weinberg effect potential. And also in the Sitter limit, it pretty much agrees with the results that I earlier published with the student, Vilanjic. Let me now just go ahead and say and try to actually, well, we numerically analyze this potential just for you to get some kind of gist understanding of what kind of effects this potential contains. So the important thing about this potential is that it contains dependence on not just the field, but also h and also explicit time dependence due to the infrared effects. And so you can begin, let's say you are in inflation. So you begin inflation with the Higgs type of potential. That means the symmetry is broken like this. And so what will typically happen here is that the infrared effects will accumulate, and they will tend to accumulate mostly around the origin of the potential, and the symmetry will be restored. So in this particular example, when epsilon is 0.1 and for certain choice of parameters, actually took 9 e-foldings of inflation for the symmetry to get actually restored. So I think this is...
This is zero. At late times, you're still inflating?
Yeah. Well...
So there's no end of inflation in this one. That's right. This is a power law because it's a fixed epsilon.
Yeah, well, we have fixed epsilon. Well...
But B0 is zero. So some other field is driving...
You can adiabatically vary epsilon.
Oh, I see.
And then if epsilon varies adiabatically, you can make an inflation to n. So hopefully that will not change hugely change this potential, of course. That's the hope, but we have not proven it.
But if it's
inflation
n, that's
very hard, right? Well, I mean, hopefully, yeah. This is not necessarily the infiltrative field. This could be the Higgs. Oh,
right.
And this could be spectator scalar. And of course, there are interesting effects associated with symmetry restoration. The particles all of a sudden become massless. And if particles are quenched from massive to massless form, there will be generally particle burst production, if that happens non-adiabatically.
And the coupling constant. Because I would expect free symmetry restoration with the mean square root perturbation of the field is of the order of the depth. And that will depend on how big the bear is, and that depends on the coupling constant. And so, and so how does that time of symmetry restoration depend on the coupling constant? If I have a very weakly coupled theory, how long is the restoration time?
I cannot answer your question, sorry, but probably you're right. It takes longer for weaker coupling theory, I would say.
But how big is the coupling for this one? Or the for the 13 EFO?
I don't know. I would have to look at the paper. There's also another thing is that if you choose psi equals 0, then symmetry restoration happens earlier for larger epsilon. That means closer to the city, it takes longer for symmetry to get restored. And another thing, which is another effect, which is interesting, if you look at around the origin, the effective mass of the fluctuations around the origin increase with time. And of course, that means that towards the end of inflation, if this is the inflaton towards the end of inflation, the inflaton will be heavier than you would naively think. And this is not unlike what you get in a thermal plasma where the field gets thermally dressed, except that this is a time-dependent effect. Okay? And so, of course, what is this all relevant for? In this particular case, if you go towards the end of inflation, this is certainly relevant for preheating. So heavier inflaton simply means that you can produce heavier particles than you would naively think. You can. But as you can see by your bare eye, that actually, obviously, the effect close to the origin is big, which also means that perturbation theory simply breaks down at late times in inflation. And there's been quite a significant amount of debate considering the so-called Higgs inflation model, if you follow the literature, where you actually have a non-Miller coupling, which is about minus 50,000, whether such a theory of inflation actually makes sense in the first sense due to the fact that perturbation theory actually breaks down during inflation or towards the end of inflation. So I think right now the tentative conclusion of this discussion is actually that towards the end of inflation, perturbative expansion breaks down. But I think this simple example shows that, well, even in a single field, usual inflation, I mean, there is nothing strange about this. It is similar, I guess, to what Richard discussed. I mean, these are kind of secular effects that do appear in inflation that can actually affect significantly your trivial results, and you have to do some kind of resummation to actually deal with this. That's probably also what happens in the case of Higgs inflation, right? So one should keep that in mind when addressing those questions as well. Well, I'm not sure what is. There is this funny feature, you know, around the origin. You know, while what actually happens at very large distances, the effect is quite small, but it becomes particularly strong around the origin. You get this funny shape, for example. Now, this is the summary on my first part. And we have now seen that there is this interesting feature. You can actually, due to quantum effects in inflation, you can actually get symmetry restoration. And as a result, in this paper with Garbrecht, we have actually looked at this simple example of fermions, where you can show that there is a fermion production in this case. So actually, our calculation was done assuming the mass changes adiabatically. But if mass changes non-adiabatically, probably production of fermions would be even more intensive. Of course, one will have to also study production of scalar photons, et cetera, et cetera. So all of those phenomena within this context would be interesting to study.
Can you stand? I just want to ask.
Yes, please.
Okay. So do you assume the bunch Davis vacuum and then evolve forward, or this is independent of the beginning of the inflation?
I assume inflation starts with some P0 or T with eta 0. And then I put it on torus.
Okay.
So that's basically what Richard and Thomas did, right? So that's what we did in calculating this potential.
And you did start with a bunch of Davis.
Yes, yes. On this initial hypersurface, there was a bunch that is. But of course, it's an infrared cutoff.
Tomislav?
Yes?
I guess I'm kind of confused at the outset. I mean, you're seeing time dependence in your potential. The background's time dependent. I mean, I would have guessed if you wanted to track what the ball, where the ball was rolling, the correct way to do it would be to start with correction to the equation of motion, sort of track those and see what happens. You know, the effective potential typically is a static quantity, and sort of, you know, think, are you really assuming that things happen so adiabatically that you can pretend that basically all you have to do is do the effective potential?
Things don't have to happen here adiabatically.
Then I don't understand how.
Look, all I've assumed here is, if you remember, I made the answers that phi background is proportional to h, and I've shown that it's consistent with my equation of motion. That's not necessarily, that's three level equation of motion, that's not necessarily adiabatic. So h here, see, h changes, you're going to see it in a moment. H changes in the following way. So your epsilon is much less than 1. You could argue that this is an adiabatic change. But if epsilon is order 1, then there is no reason for adiabaticity to be true, right? So you know that this goes as 1 over epsilon t.
But maybe what he means is that among other things, you would expect in general them to have a non-local.
Sure, in general. But in this special case,
wouldn't I have to go back, so take your ansatz and go back and check to see that those non-local terms that you would have
You're right. So what actually happens, you're completely right. What happens here is if you actually now plug in back in the background field into the quantum corrected equation, you're going to discover that the quantum correction to the effective potential breaks down the classical invariance. So you're completely right in that way.
Okay.
So, and it breaks it down simply to the fact that through normalization you introduce a scale, which is a fixed physical scale, and it does not scale with h anymore, of course. So that's one way of breaking it. And the other one is the infrared cutoff breaks it as well. So we have two scales that actually come from quantum effects that do break out trivial invariance. Sorry, I misunderstood your question.
So, in your model, where is the inflation field? I mean, it is near the origin or high up in the potential?
This calculation is strictly, as I said, you know, for this particular configuration, which solves that equation. But of course, you can also imagine that you have an inflaton, which is slowly rolling. So you cannot really consider that case.
Could I ask about your work here? I guess I'm not so familiar with it. Can you generate a lepton asymmetry if you, or a varying asymmetry if you couple it to a more complicated kind of theory? Generate the variable asymmetry during inflation this way?
Yes, you would have to have a complex scalar at least. I mean, even maybe it's two scalar fields, so we'll have to generalize it. But in principle, you're right, yeah. But of course, then we'd have to tune it in such a way that the symmetry is sort towards the end of inflation, otherwise the variance would be diluted. Okay, so let me now move on to the second part of my talk, which, I will just say that now I'm going to talk about the back reaction. And you're all familiar with this equation, so this is just Einstein's equation. And, of course, in the semi-classical regime of the Einstein equation, there is a correction to it that can come from matter fields or gravitational fields, which is just the excitation value of the quantum tensor with respect to some state. And to solve this equation consistently with fluctuations in cosmology is, of course, hopelessly hard. But what I would like to study here in the rest of my talk is try to understand whether there are any conditions in cosmology under which this term can become comparable to that term. And of course, if that happens, then you would want to say that then you want to solve self-consistently the equation, this equation that includes both of those terms. But first, before we start to try to do this equation self-consistently, let me try to understand under what conditions this term will become comparable to that term. And of course, if that ever happens, then it's worth asking the question whether this guy can ever play a role of dark energy, for example, right? So dark energy could be quantum after all. So this is then the relevant question. And of course, in inflation, we have one argument against this, because gravitational potential that comes from quantum fluctuations here is typically small, 10 minus 5. So unless there are some secular growing effects, so this effect, when you insert this here, you will always get a small effect, 10 minus 10. So the answer is, are there these secular terms present? And to address this question, I will start with a simple toy model. That means I will just switch off gravity. I will assume gravity is non-dynamical, and I will focus myopically on the universe filled with scalars. And again, I'll assume epsilon constant universe or constant decelerating universe. And nevertheless, this toy model is interesting because it's a model for graviton. Yeah, sure. Just like what I did in this effective potential case. I mean, I integrated over all wavelengths except for the zero mode. All. So, sorry? Yes.
There are actually a number of cases where you can actually do these kind of calculations. For instance, if you consider some field which is non-conformal, but the mass is not too is smaller compared to the Hubble radius, it's relatively light, mm-hmm. then you can actually calculate this effective action, mm-hmm. this perturbative expansion mm-hmm. in n squared over h squared, for instance, or also if it has a non-conformal sure. coupling. And so you can calculate exactly the conformal action, including the non-local terms, and you can solve the back reaction equations, and you also see some interesting things like very related to what
was
saying, that you have some local term which grows with the logarithm of a, and if you don't include the contribution from the non-local terms that you can calculate explicitly, then you have large effects. But
yeah,
if you include those,
but
you
know, who has done that?
We did that.
In the center?
So the effective action you can calculate for general Robertson worker, the non-local.
But then you have to have n much greater than h.
Right. So you can have either the conformal calculate
okay.
as it.
Yeah, yeah. But in my case, n is much less than h.
Yeah. So there are cases where.
For general Robertson.
No, if n is much larger, then you can. The effective action, yes.
Yeah, sure.
For a conformal equation.
No. You can do it also for non-conformal, as long as you can treat the mass perturbative.
Yeah. No, you can.
The non-conformal coupling.
You can treat it also in WKB, as we've heard this morning,
that's
right?
That's when it's large.
Exactly.
So you have these two
exactly.
where you can calculate.
Exactly.
When it's small, you can do
but the effects are reduced.
When it's large, you
yes.
use WKB.
Exactly. But the effects are strongest, as we know, precisely in the opposite regime.
Yeah, so the only thing I was saying
yeah.
is that it's hopelessly hard. Not always. There are a number of regimes.
Sure,
so you
sure.
can calculate exactly.
Okay,
and
you're, right. How,
regime
you're right. You're right. What I'm trying to say. The regime in which the back reaction is expected to be strongest is hard. Okay? That's maybe the right statement. So again, this is my Friedman equation, this is my notation. B means background, and I'll introduce notation Q that means quantum. So if I write rho B, this is the energy of the background, and I'm assuming perfect fluid. My second Friedman equation is just constant equals constant, and it relates to the equation of state parameter of the background with the epsilon parameter. That's all. And just for your information, you see A goes as T to the power 1 over epsilon, and H scales, as I already wrote, as A to minus epsilon. And all I'll calculate is this contribution, with one loop contribution with the stress energy insertion. And I'll do it in the following way. I will actually calculate the scalar coincident and then act with the inversion to get the trace of stress energy tensor, and I think I excluded the anomaly here, sorry. but this equation, and then I know conservation law, will tell me that if I know this guy, I can calculate this up to radiation type of constant and the pressure. So then I can solve for the full quantum stress energy tensor as soon as I have scalar appropriate at coincidence.
Isn't the emission of the anomaly a problem? I mean, is it?
I assume that it's small. Sorry. You can, right? Sorry?
It's just a curvature, so you know how big it is. So it's,
sure, sure.
Right? Why is it small compared to what you're talking
about? I don't know. I mean, I assume it's small. You can check whether...
Is curvature a square?
I have, yes. It comes...
With h to the 4, so how big are the things you're keeping?
I think... Normally, because it's an ultraviolet effect, it's mostly ultraviolet effect, maybe. It does not have this Paolo growth that I'm going to talk about today, which I'm myopically focused on. So normally, do not contribute to that type of terms that I'm interested in.
If I wanted to have in mind a small dimensionless thing that controls the size of it, what would I think of? It's h divided by something.
It's order h to the fourth. Multiplied maybe by epsilon squared, things like this, maybe even epsilon cubed.
The dimensionless thing is h squared divided by a Planck square, right?
Yeah.
But why is the relative size between that and the things you
calculate? Yeah, what I'm calculating is bigger, I guarantee. So anyway, there is, so this is the model, I think you have seen it. The scale equation of motion, again, you decompose it. If you neglect interactions, you can decompose it to create relation operators. Some kind of vacuum state. The solution in constant epsilon spaces you can write in terms of Hankel functions. But what is not familiar to you is actually the index nu. And the index nu is now dependent also on xi and epsilon in this way. Since I don't assume epsilon is small, I don't expand in epsilon. And alpha and beta, of course, satisfy the Bogoliubov relation. And for the propagator, you can just write it in terms of the mod, so this is the propagator equation. And you can solve it, and the naive solution will look like this. Indeed, dimensions, and this is the nice solution to use for dimensional organization, but again, that solution does not contain the right infrared properties, so somehow the infrared divergences are automatically subtracted for, and you have to correct for this. And this is the d-dimensional form for the new parameter here now. So you can also see it in d-dimensions. So this is the familiar propagator. Again, the only difference is basically with what you're familiar with is that there is this parameter nu here. And now, what I will do now next is the following. So
I'm going to stop you again, because the equation you're solving was something like box, t was box phi squared, and then we're not including curvature, square term, which is the anomaly, right?
I'm including it, yeah, because it's here, it's like c. C parameter is c comes from curvature.
But the anomaly you omitted, which would have been a curvature square term in that equation. And so the thing is, you're keeping things like box h squared, which is like h dot squared or something like that.
Where?
The things in an order of magnitude, the things you're keeping are things like box of phi squared.
I'm not keeping box a squared. What?
Can you show us the equation you're talking about? It's
the propagator.
No, the previous
slide. That's the equation I'm solving.
No, previous slide. You had a slide.
No, but the other one was classical. I mean, the other one is not.
The quantum stress energy.
That one up there, right? The quantum stress energy phase. Are we using that formula somewhere?
Yes.
So the thing is, you're keeping in that formula things like box of expectation of phi squared, and I'm thinking that's of the order of h squared. So it's like a box h squared term in that equation.
Yeah.
But the anomaly in that equation would have been a curvature to the squared term, which is like an h to the fourth term.
Yeah.
And so I don't see why, if you're allowed to keep box h squared in a slow rule, why can you even neglect h?
Maybe you're right. Okay. But I think what we neglected is subdominance, but... Let me proceed. We can discuss this. I mean, people have discussed this term in other contexts. I think it gives a small effect. So, but let me just present my model, and then otherwise I will not finish my talk. So, so the model is the following. We begin with Bunch-Davis vacuum in reflection in radiation era, and we match it suddenly to a constant epsilon space. So the matching is sudden. And of course, you all know that the Bunch-Davis in radiation has no infrared problem whatsoever. And when you do sudden matching, the constant epsilon space will inherit the good property, infrared properties of the infrared. Some people would say, of course, by causality. But anyway, this is what happens. So you can do this matching, And then you can solve for the propagator, except that you cannot. So I will tell you what we actually do. But before I tell you this, let me just tell you the following fact. If you actually look at the phi-square correlator in the infrared section, then if you put some cutoffs, this is what it is. And in the infrared, that means before it starts oscillating, it has a k to the power 3 minus the nu. And of course, nu has to be, in order for this to be regular, nu has to be, in the infrared, nu has to be sufficiently, how does it work? Big or small? Small, right? For it to, yes, sufficiently small, less than 3/2. Exactly. When it's sufficiently small, then, of course, if k is zero, minimal coupling, all that means that you have epsilon has to be greater than 3/2. So that means that when epsilon is between 0 and 3/2, this guy will be infrared divergent, and that's a problem that we are trying to solve here. So, but this regime means nothing but whenever rho background is less than zero, p background is less than zero. So any negative pressure background will have this infrared property. You probably know it. Of course, when xi is non-zero, non-minimal coupling, situation is slightly more complicated, and so you cannot plot it anymore as a simple range, but it's actually a two-dimensional range where there are infrared issues. So this range here. Radiation error is a special case. There are no problems, and then there is this issue here. So of course, you can ask how come that when the epsilon is greater than 2, I also have infrared problems. But the reason is because Ricci's scalar is negative, so when xi becomes positive, that corresponds to giving negative mass to fluctuations. And then again, if it is big enough, then there are infrared issues here. But of course, for us, maybe it's more interesting this part of the plot. Matter error is this point here, or 3/2, right? This point here. So, and what we are after? We are after to rewriting this quantum correction as a perfect fluid, which is characterized by energy density and pressure. And quantum means index Q, and classical means index background B. And we are after the following situation. If my quantum part scales in a certain way, characterized by WQ, and classical part scales with WB, then on the log-log plot, I will have something like this. And this is the situation I'm interested in, because in this case, you see the background scales faster than the quantum part. And when it comes to equations, this is the only equation I want you to remember from my talk. It's, I think, sufficiently simple. WQ less than WB. If that is true, then this situation will occur. And after sufficient amount of time, you will actually, the rho Q will become dominant over rho B. And that's all I will try to establish in my talk today, whether this ever happens. And of course, after that happens, then this solution breaks down and we have to solve itself consistently. I will not do it today. And of course, the interesting question here is, you see, this ratio here is typically very big initially, so if this happens, there is a big time delay before this to become comparable. So if this actually happens, that could also explain a big delay with respect to some other time when we do the matching.
Say in the entropy, the number of e-folds that you need for that to happen?
Well, here it's 8. I mean, no. I mean, you can see, you can actually, this formula, I think, precisely that you ask is here. That time in which this happens is h of m Planck, which is the scale of fluctuations and the matching, times this ratio 1 over the difference between the w's, and times 1 plus W. Okay, that's basically the time. Does this answer the question?
I think so.
Okay, thanks. Sorry.
I have a question. You are basically taking a superposition of many states of the field, by some of the infrared modes, right?
Sure.
However, you let them react, you let them back react on a single classical metric, which is your background. This to me looks worrying, or maybe even inconsistent. Because if I, of course, take the opposite point of view, that there's the coherence, and each classical field configuration comes with its own background, then nothing will happen except that the universe will become, will have large fluctuations, so to speak, but there will not be a local change of expansion rate. So I think I'm concerned by this isometric treatment of field and metric.
So my idea is that if I was able to solve these two equations of consistency, I would have a good solution. And you have to really, I mean, you can say this is what I don't believe, but I say I believe, but unless you give me an argument, scientific argument, then.
So, in fact, there's also a way in which you can try to see whether what the effect that he's referring to is relevant or not, which is that you can look at the fluctuations that you would have. This is a mean field approximation. And you can look at the fluctuations, and for instance, you can see that they are generated by the fluctuations on the stress tensor. So you can, for instance, estimate that by looking at the two point
parameters. This is the cleanest way I know how to do it. So let's discuss it later, please. I mean,
I'm just saying that would be a way of estimating whether the effect that he's pointing out.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fluctuations in space. I think Vilenkin a long time ago showed that the fluctuations in space are not very big from stochastic effects.
But not just in space, but also within your patch. You want to see whether.
I mean, this is not what we are asking. I mean,
the issue that he was worried about is fluctuations in space.
I think he was also worried about the fact that you have summing over different quantum realizations.
I'm worried that he has different quantum realizations of the field, and he takes all that together and defines one metric that goes with it.
Yeah,
I think it looks.
Yes, so this is an ensemble, this is a quantum average at the same time as an ensemble average. That's my approach. And we can discuss whether there is a more reasonable approach. But what I'm trying to say is, you see, I put all these time, spatial dependent effects into another part which I didn't show here. All of them, including those ones you're worried about. Anything that is spatially varying is another part sector of my theory. Okay, so let me please. Yeah. I'm just discussing the zero mode here. And if
he considered that even for homogeneous mode, you would have this effect that you would have different realizations, and you are summing over the contribution of all of them back reacting.
Okay, so. Method,
whereas he's pointing out.
Look, this is the only way how I know how to do quantum average, if I do average over all realizations.
You could say that each field configuration has its own metric. And so nothing particular happens, but the field rolls faster or somewhat slower in different areas.
Look,
each time the same local expansion rate, the one.
As I said, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing. You see,
that's clear.
You see, that what you are saying is relevant for zeta variable, but this is not zeta. This is something else. Okay, so there is another zeta. I couldn't resist, so I have a zeta here. But zeta correspond to AH at the matching divided by AH at as a function of time after the matching, right? And actually, the referee objected to our earlier symbol, so we had to change it to something else. So we have then chosen zeta. But this is the best result we could actually find. This is an exact result for the two-point function at coincidence. Unfortunately, off coincidence, we could never find it. And as you see, it has a divergent part and dimensional organization, and everything else is finite. And since this is an analytic form, you can now expand it, for example, in powers of zeta, which is appropriate late-time limit in the accelerated space, or you can expand it model with zeta, the same result, and you get an expansion in the decelerating case, because that parameter actually grows as time goes on in the decelerating universes. So you can study both. And we did. And I'll basically now just tell you the results. So if you we plot it as function of epsilon, WB background and WQ. And if you remember this relation that I asked you to remember, we are interested in a situation when WQ is less than WB. And WB by Friedman equation is just minus 1 plus 2 thirds epsilon. And in the case of C is 0, basically this is what you have, what happens. I mean, what you see is the blue curve is always above the red curve, which means that quantum effects scale faster, so they become even smaller with respect to the classical term. And secondly, there are two points where they touch each other, and those two points, and one of them is the sitter, they could be secular logarithmic growth, because that still corresponds to the same scaling in my approximation. And indeed, we have studied those points separately, and we did discover there is a logarithmic growth. But logarithmic growth seems to be much slower, so we don't consider it satisfactory. Now, if you put C positive, you see what happens is, again, this is my classical curve, and these are different choices of C, small C and larger C, order 1. And what you see is when C is larger, you enter for sufficiently large epsilon again. For the first time, well, you enter the regime when instability, well, maybe this is not a very physical regime, but still, it can happen for non-zero C. Now, when C is negative, that regime happens somewhere between 1 and 2, where there is a crossing between the red and blue curves, and you see that below the critical value, there is precisely the regime you want. That means that the quantum energy density, in this case, slower than the classical energy density, eventually will dominate. So this is maybe the main result here on my talk. So you need negative C. And to summarize the results, you know, this is the region where quantum energy density, in this case, slower than the classical, and this region here. And the boundary is given by this formula, and here the boundary is given by these two little formulas.
So that region includes near epsilon equals zero, if I remember, if you go back to that. You could think of epsilon
sure.
Being
close to epsilon equals zero, as long as C is negative, it can be small, you have a growth. Pauli growth.
So you could just study it in the de Sitter limit, basically.
Yeah, but precisely the de Sitter point, on this line you have to study separately. Typically on this line there is no growth or there is logarithmic growth. But inside this region there is Pauli growth. Relative Pauli growth. Yes? Yes.
Okay, so when you adopt
it, I don't understand your question. So
you are considering the wrong way and not forget the driving. And you are taking the
adiabatic
function.
Yeah, I'm taking, yes. So
when you adopt it, the initial condition to reach the adiabatic function, you need to.
No, we don't take WKB. This is an exact analysis. So my space-time is broken to sigma cross R, and I take all the modes. My state is defined on infinite space. So all the modes are taken into account. Except for the homogeneous mode. I don't know. I mean, we don't take any WKB approximation.
Yeah, but in case of the equation, we can adopt
the interpolation because the interesting modes within the horizon.
So, but in case you start from the
acceleration
phase,
yeah.
How do you adopt the interpolation?
Bands
waves
initially, at all scales.
Why do you jump very bands waves?
Because it's infinite safe in radiation error. Okay. So, of course, you can ask the question whether this is relevant for dark energy. And if C is negative, maybe, but one will really have to do more detailed study, and I'm now working on this with Tommy Previsto.
But again, just to be clear, so for in the de Sitter case, with negative C, you say that that would be the simplest example of that.
Exactly. Okay. Well, not de Sitter. I mean, you de Sitter. Yeah, but I mean, we don't live in de Sitter. I mean, it's.
No, we don't, but we could test whether there's an effect there, and that's what you seem to be claiming.
Well, at the Mongoloop order, this effect is in the de Sitter limit proportional. There is epsilon log A that survives when there is no C. and epsilon goes to zero, so the log drops out. It happens that way in one loop order, two loop order.
You said when there's no C.
Yes.
But, yeah, so let's just take C to be negative and epsilon to be zero.
Right, then there is an effect, yes.
Okay. So that's the
simplest case. It's power law. Okay. Yeah, that's the simplest case. And, well, this is some kind of a summary. I think I'm not going to tell you what what's in there. I already basically told you about it. I would like to say just a couple of words with we've also done a similar study with gravitons, but we actually didn't do this radiation inflation matching. We've actually done it on a convolving box. It's easier. It turns out that in accelerating cases, we've tested it. Qualitatively, the answers are the same. That means the power law that you actually get coming from the infrared scaling of the dominant energy density turns out to be the same. But of course, for gravitons, things are much more messy. There's a coupling between the scalar and the tensor mode, and, well, one way of dealing with this is to actually solve the graviton equation, and then you have to basically diagonalize it, and we actually did it. And you have to also regulate it in the infrared, but basically the picture you get is roughly the one that you've already seen it in the accelerating regime. So the gravitons are, again, at one loop order harmless. Of course, we have no idea what happens at two. How much do I have left? Zero. Let me just then say in words, in 0 minutes, this is the work that I've done recently with Tommy Coivisto. And what I haven't mentioned anything about ultraviolet regularization here. And we had some problems there which are mentioned. And of course, you can remove those problems by counter terms. But of course, the question is, can you get rid of those problems in the first place? And you can if you do the smooth matching. That was the conclusion of our paper. But of course, the smooth matching means direct epsilon, and then you need a propagator for this. So I was thinking for a long time about the propagator for epsilon non-constant space, which starts somewhere when epsilon is big enough so that you have regular infrared states, and then it changes to the vacuum where would be divergent infrared states. And of course, as it changes, there is a mod mixing, and due to mod mixing, there are no infrared divergences here. And we managed actually to solve we actually managed to find out the case. You know, this is the case in conformal time. For the scale factor, this is the solution in terms of Bessel function. Now, these are not mode functions. These are true dependence of the scale factor on conformal time. So it's an exact solution. And it turns out, so you can just plot epsilon as a function of time. There is also a bound solution, not just an expanding solution. So this is sort of, this is an example, H as a function of time, you see there is a bounce. For different cases, when asymptotically you have the sitter, or asymptotically some other space-times. Then we have also studied, we have to make sure that we start with a state which by Bunch-Davis is regular. So these white regions are where Bunch-Davis is regular, otherwise it's singular. And then we calculate the back reaction. And the mode functions, again, suspiciously look like Hankel functions. You've seen them. However, the difference is there is some parameter gamma that actually serves as the infrared cutoff. And this gamma here is also appears in the equation for the scale factor. So that's this gamma. And it's essentially a measure of space-time curvature.
So I think this answers the question I had. You can't get the propagator off coincidence, but you can get the coincident propagator because the thing that would have prevented getting the off coincident propagator, the mixing terms, just becomes a tractable function. Is that correct?
Probably, yeah. I mean, in this case, we cannot even do what we did in the other case. We can only construct coincident propagator for half integer modes. And we started the back reaction. And maybe I should just show you one plot. See, what you see here, C negative, this is omega back reaction, the ratio of energies. And again, it grows. For C zero, stays constant. For C negative, positive, it decays. So the results exactly reproduce our results that I had with Thomas in the earlier paper, right? So we basically confirmed our results, but now with the our only ultraviolet renormalization term was R squared. There are no further infinities. No infinities are generated at the batching. So this is a purely, I would say, kosher calculation from that point of view. But as you see, the results are unchanged. So I would say one more sentence, and that sentence is that here, apart from the fact that the Beck reaction grows when C is less than zero, we could also get superinflation here as at late time. And in that case, also the background energy density grows. Of course, that period could last for a while, and then it would go again to some normal state. So, but that's also, I think, a potential interesting regime, because in this model, we can actually get superinflation for a finite period of time, and then comes back to normal inflation. So that is also maybe a potentially interesting and new case where we haven't studied before. So anyway, that's basically all I want to say. Well, you see, if you plug this in the scale factor,
yeah.
if you've seen, the scale factor contains.
Yeah, I know how to get the scale.
This is what enters the rescaled mode functions acquired this A double prime of A in the equation of motion, right?
So you're saying it just subsumes itself into some integration constant?
The only difference between the standard case you're used to is this gamma here.
I'm not asking about the scale factor. I know how to get the scale factor. What I don't know how to do is for a scale factor which isn't constant epsilon, I don't know how to get the mode functions.
Well, the mode functions in the rescaled mode functions obey this equation. I'm sure you've seen it.
Yes, many times.
So all I'm saying, you see, we actually modify this term by this innocent-looking constant, gamma.
Yes.
That's all we did. And this enters now together with K. So, of course, the mode solution, therefore, by very simple reasoning, is just a shift of K squared by gamma.
So it's not a constant epsilon?
No, it's not. You see, because if you solve this equation now, the exact solution to that equation is this one. One peculiar property of that space-time is that you cannot extend it to asymptotically past. You have to start at a finite time, so it has a big bang. But okay, not everything is perfect in the world, right? Well, the other one you can extend to asymptotic past. This one you cannot.
Any other questions? There were a lot of questions during the talk, so why don't we thank Thomas Hobb again.